Hi, everybody, and welcome to Trendlines, a podcast on global affairs brought to you by World Politics Review. I'm Judah Grunstein, WPR's editor-in-chief. A little later for this week's report, WPR senior editor Robbie Corey-Boulet will be talking with Rafael Tzavco-Garcia about the dream of an independent Basque state in northern Spain after the demise of the violent Basque separatist group known as ETA, which formally disbanded earlier this year. But first, Freddie's out on vacation this week, so I'll be talking with Robbie myself. Hi, Robbie.
Hey, Judah.
We'll be discussing the Helsinki summit between Donald Trump and Vladimir Putin and its aftermath. Before we get started, let me mention up top to everyone listening that if you'd like to drop us a line with questions or comments, you can email us at podcast@worldpoliticsreview.com. Robbie, it's hard to know where to start given all the fallout from the summit. What about it jumped out to you most?
Well, I think the first thing that jumped out at me was just how amazing it is that this meeting between Trump and Putin took place in a venue that's actually called the Hall of Mirrors. It's one of those incredible details from the Trump era that if you were like sitting around a table at a writer's room in a TV show and you pitched it, the feedback would be like, no, that's way too on the nose.
Too obvious.
Right. But this is the world we're living in, I guess. I think, you know,
he's not exactly known for his subtlety, right?
No, I guess not. It's all part of the show. What is remarkable to me as well is the fact that, you know, in the lead up to this summit and during the summit and now in the aftermath of the summit, no one from the American side can tell you what the point of this was, or what this whole exercise was intended to achieve. And the president certainly can't make a convincing case either. I mean, he said, in two cases now, both in Singapore after meeting Kim Jong-un and now in Helsinki, he's set the bar about as low as he possibly can by saying, you know, we're doing this for the sake of dialogue. My predecessors let things get so bad, but now I'm having these meetings and we're lowering tensions. I think in the case of North Korea, you could have an argument about that. I mean, we weren't in touch with the North Koreans, and there's at least a case to be made that we should have been. The other side of that argument being, of course, that by granting a summit without getting anything in return, you're forfeiting a huge amount of U.S. leverage. But in the case of Russia, it doesn't really make a lot of sense. I mean, we are in contact with the Russians. We're in touch with them all the time. We have embassies, we have ambassadors and other diplomats. We know that because those are the people we kick out of the country when Russia poisons former spies on the soil of our close allies. Sergei Lavrov had a meeting in the Oval Office the day after, I think, James Comey was fired. So in the case of Russia, you know, having this kind of dialogue is not necessarily an achievement in and of itself, especially without good faith engagement from Putin and, you know, a willingness to negotiate on the sticking points. And we just don't know if that happened because the details of the actual meeting were secret. You know, only the translators were allowed in.
I was going to say that not only do we not know the point of the meeting, we don't know what the agreements that the Russian side is already referring to are about. I agree with you entirely. It's almost as if the point of the meeting for Trump, at least, I think for Putin, the point of the meeting is a little clearer because it definitively and finally breaks the idea of Russia and Putin as somehow under quarantine, even if that was misleading in the sense that he's met with the Chinese president, he's met with the South Korean president, he's met with the Japanese prime minister, he's met with the French president, Angela Merkel, the German chancellor. So the idea that he was somehow persona non grata is not necessarily true. But Obama had pointedly refused to meet with him since the meddling in the election, and so the U.S. president was the last remaining trophy really for Putin, and he got it. For Trump, it's almost as if the whole point of the summit was just because he wasn't allowed to do it by the conventional wisdom because of the behavior that the U.S. is reproaching Russia for, predominantly the breach in terms of the meddling in the election, but also the the cloud of controversy over Trump's campaign and over the election itself would have seemed to under conventional political optics, Trump would be avoiding Putin like the plague. And because of that, it's almost as if he had to prove that he could basically counter conventional wisdom and just do what he wanted to do. I hesitate to get into the whole aspect of whether or not Putin has compromising material on Trump, whether it precedes the election or involves the election itself. Because it's speculative still at this point, even if there are a lot of dots that are leading to that conclusion. And B, in some ways, it doesn't really matter or change much in the sense that, if you get even past the meetings and whatever was agreed upon, when you get to that press conference after the meeting between the two leaders and their teams at that point, and you have this spectacle of the president of the United States just trashing the United States intelligence community and its conclusions about what Putin had done and ordered done in the U.S. election. To me, it doesn't really matter anymore whether Trump is personally compromised because he just didn't do what would be expected of an American president to really defend the U.S. national interests.
Right. And, you know, I take your point that, yeah, in the end, the substance doesn't change too much, regardless of what the leverage Russia might have over Trump is. You do get the sense that it's very much what was on Trump's mind. I mean, this perception, and also that he's playing very much to his domestic political base, which is a point that you and Freddie made when talking about his behavior at the NATO summit last week. Yeah, a lot of people talk about the effects that these summits have on multilateral institutions like NATO and the EU, or, you know, going out a bit farther to the WTO or the Paris Climate Accord. And Trump has a disdain for these institutions, but he also just has like a total disregard or lack of concern for why they're important or whether they should survive. And so that lack of concern allows him not to worry about them at all. And so a question about, you know, Russian election meddling at the press conference, which is a question fundamentally about an assault on American democracy by a foreign power, gets a response evoking Trump's electoral college win or Hillary Clinton's emails. You know, that's the stuff that Trump cares about, his political career and his own successes, and he's kind of incapable of seeing beyond that. So I understand, you know, when that is what happens at the press conference, why these questions are raised domestically about, you know, what is Trump's angle? What is he doing?
It's fascinating to me because I'm of a generation, and it's not necessarily generational, but I'm particularly of a generation where it would have been unimaginable for a Republican president to be playing to his domestic political base by essentially playing footsie with the president of Russia against the conclusions of the U.S. intelligence community. I talked about that a little bit in my column this week, that I get the sense almost that Trump, through the whatever strange charismatic appeal he has to his base, is in the process of single-handedly transforming the Republican Party. I made the analogy in my column to 1968, and the McGovern candidacy for the Democratic Party, which turned the party of FDR, Truman, Kennedy, and LBJ, who were not at all considered doves in any sense of the word. And the Democratic Party had never been associated with being weak on national security. But with that one election cycle in 68, for two generations afterward, the Democratic Party really had to defend itself against this claim that it was weak on national security. And wrongly so, I would argue, if you look at the record of the various presidents. With Trump, it's fascinating. You have him transforming the party of Reagan, essentially, into most Republican presidents have been more unilateralist, sure, but anti-free trade, anti-NATO, which is unimaginable, against the American alliance systems in Asia, and against or not defending the values that the U.S. government has traditionally at least paid lip service to. I don't want to gloss over the ways in which the U.S. government hasn't lived up to the values of democracy, for instance, human rights and things like that. But there's always been the rhetorical defense. Trump doesn't even go that far. And then if you add to that the what you see in the Democratic Party in the U.S. now, where it's almost an article of faith that you believe the U.S. intelligence community and the FBI, which again, progressives in the U.S. were often very critical of the FBI in terms of some of the overreaches in terms of domestic civil liberties and things like that. So it's really almost like a reversal of the two poles that have long defined the two parties. And what I mentioned in my column, just to wrap up, is that what it means is that consensus in U.S. foreign policy that used to survive the changing of administrations could really be over. And so you might have these radical reversals every 4 or 8 years, depending on whether a Democrat or a Republican is in the White House, which would add an element of uncertainty permanently to U.S. foreign policy.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. He is transforming the Republican Party. I guess the question is whether he can do it fast enough to ensure his own political survival. I think it's pretty clear that at least among base Republican voters, he's been able to win people over on these arguments against the utility of NATO and also on his trade arguments. I don't know that that's necessarily the case for Republican representatives in Congress. You know, I think there are plenty of people who similarly can imagine thinking that this would be an incredible set of circumstances, having the U.S. president go to Helsinki and meet with the Russian leader inside against his intelligence agencies. And the question is, you know, whether those representatives are so beholden to their base that they're unwilling to act on those thoughts, or whether, you know, there is an inflection point at which they will say, you know, this kind of behavior is unacceptable and jeopardizes American interests, and the president needs to be held accountable for that. And I think we're kind of in the middle of one of those weeks where there's some optimism that might be the case, you know, that people might start turning on some of Trump's more radical activity, but I don't know that that's going to happen.
I had considered that at the beginning of the week when I was watching the press conference. I wondered whether this might be what I called in my column Trump's emperor has no clothes moment, where people's illusions sort of melt away and they actually see him for what he is. But the last polling I saw this afternoon on Thursday suggests that something like 85% of Republicans approve of his handling of the Helsinki summit. So I think that there's definitely a major disconnect between, like you said, the Republican leaders in Congress and in Washington and the base. And I think that we're going to be seeing that play out especially over the next couple of election cycles. The question is whether Trump or not, whether those changes are permanent or lasting in the Republican Party, I think. And then you could really see probably a changing of the leadership in Washington to more reflect that base. I guess before we wrap up our discussion, I think the one thing that jumps out at me most about the summit, the aftermath, and it's also a permanent feature of Trump's presidency, is the way in which it's almost impossible not to talk about it as if it's a reality TV show or some sort of theater, like professional wrestling or something like that, a very sort of a popular and populist theater. Obviously, summits and summitry have always had that aspect. For the most part, they've been relatively boring affairs, or else there were momentous achievements to announce. In this case, it's all pageantry and very little substance that we know of it, at the very least. But it just strikes me the degree to which politics and entertainment at this point have become basically interchangeable. And I don't think Trump is entirely responsible for that or solely responsible, but I think that he uniquely, so far in America's political history, he uniquely has managed to benefit and exploit it in terms of his use of Twitter, for instance, his whole persona. I can't think of another politician that's in a better position to take advantage of that. Any last thoughts before we wrap up?
Yeah, so we talked about this idea of, you know, potentially there being a turning point domestically in terms of how Trump is perceived and treated. I mean, I think it's also worth looking at the extent to which internationally the same kind of inflection point is happening. And I think there were a few events this week or developments that suggested that were there already. You know, the German government has already made clear that it doesn't consider the U.S. under Trump to be an ally that it can rely on. European leaders seem to be coming around to that more and more. EU leaders met with China this week and issued a statement about effectively maintaining the global order. The EU signed its massive trade deal with Japan. You really do get the sense that people are looking elsewhere. And I guess the question is whether this is a temporary shift in the way the world is run, or if Trump is ushering in something that's more permanent.
A very good point. In other words, despite all the spectacle surrounding Trump, other global leaders actually have to deal with a real vacuum in terms of U.S. policy and U.S. leadership, and they're not standing still. So not only what you said in terms of the global order, but whether once Trump is no longer president, whether they will consider the United States and deal with the United States in the way they have historically have, whether the allies or adversaries. Good point.
Right.
Two things I want to mention to everyone listening before we get to the Who Said That segment. First, please make sure to leave a rating and review of the podcast on iTunes or wherever it is you subscribe to it. That helps us spread the word about what we're doing. And second, if you want to keep up to date on the topics we're covering at WPR, go ahead and sign up for our free newsletter. It includes a daily preview and a weekly recap with free access to unlocked articles all week long, all at no cost. To sign up, just go to bit.ly/WPR podcast. All right, Robbie, it's been a while, I think, since you've done a Who Said That, if you ever have. Have you got a tough one for me?
Well, we'll see how tough it is. Okay, here is the quote. "Look around. Strongman politics are ascendant suddenly, whereby elections and some pretense of democracy are maintained, the form of it, but those in power seek to undermine every institution or norm that gives democracy meaning."
That's Barack Obama giving a speech at a homage to Nelson Mandela in South Africa, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, a bit of a throwback, and clearly I need to make these a bit tougher, but good job.
I've got one for you. Let's see if you get it. Mm-hmm. "In today's world, it does not matter how big or small you are, but to what extent you cherish the values of freedom, solidarity, and democracy."
It almost sounds like it could be the same person.
I was going to say.
But I don't think it is. I don't remember that from Obama's speech, but I'm kind of drawing a blank. So go ahead.
That was the official statement from the government of Montenegro, responding to Trump's comments after his summit with Putin, describing the country as tiny and aggressive, and possibly the cause of World War III.
All right.
Which WPR article from this week would you like to flag for everyone?
We had a piece on Thursday by Richard Hedarian on a backlash within the Philippines to President Duterte's foreign policy and specifically his embrace of China. A few weeks ago, we had a feature about the domestic backlash to the drug war, and I thought this briefing was a nice complement to that, focusing on how the defense establishment and foreign policy elites within the Philippines are worried about Duterte as well.
I agree. And I'll mention Eric Olson's article about Mexican president-elect Andrés Manuel López Obrador's plans for reshaping the country's security policy, including security coordination with the U.S. AMLO, as he's known, won the July 1st election against the backdrop of rising violence that saw almost 29,000 Mexicans killed last year. He'll take office in December. All right, Robbie, great stuff. Thanks.
Thank you, Judah.
And now I'll pass it right back over to you for the report.
Thank you.
Earlier this year, ETA, the separatist group in the Basque region of northern Spain, announced that it would dissolve. The news came as little surprise, given that the group's membership and support had been dwindling for some time. But as Rafael Savco Garcia writes in this week's in-depth report for WPR, the end of ETA does not mean that pro-separatist voices have disappeared. Rafael, how are you today?
Yeah, I'm fine, thanks.
Great. Well, thanks very much for being with us. To start, I wanted to just ask you about this announcement that ETA made in April, that it would dissolve and that it would shut down all of its operations. What was the reaction to that news in the Basque region?
At least to most people that I've talked with, it was pure joy, happiness. A bit that feeling of it came too late, the announcement, but at least we have now the announcement, so it's time to move on to a new political scenario in the Basque Country.
And can you tell us a little bit about the group's origins? Why was it founded back in 1959? Who were its first leaders, and what were their goals?
Well, first, to understand that, you have to go back a little bit to 1952, when a group of students from the University of Deusto in Bilbao, they decided to form a group called Ekin, which in Basque means to learn, also to insist. It was a group dedicated to promote the Basque language and Basque culture among students of the city of Bilbao and San Sebastian. In 56, they decided to merge with the youth of the Basque Nationalist Party, and a way to go further in the objectives, also to add some political background to them. But they thought after a few years that the Basque Nationalist Party was too soft on the struggle against the Franco regime, and they were frustrated. A few internal conflicts began, and in 59 they decided to form ETA with members of the Basque Nationalist Youth and a few members of other radical nationalist organizations. From a student group, they decided to become a group of promoting direct action, propaganda, agitation, and in time, armed struggle.
And you mentioned Francisco Franco, the dictator who came to power after the Spanish Civil War. So is he defined as ETA's main opponent? I mean, that's who they were organizing against?
No, the truth is that the main objective of ETA was, and still is until this moment, the independence of the Basque Country. To defeat Franco was just a step. It was part of the struggle, but not exactly the most important one. It was just a step to go to the main objective.
And so what role did violence play, if any, in ETA's early activities in the years after it was first formed? And when and why did ETA start to embrace violence more consistently?
Well, ETA embraced violence by 1964, just after they branded itself as a socialist movement. But only in 1968, they carried out the first attack, which wasn't planned. It was the assassination of a civil guard called José Pardines. He was shot dead during a routine traffic stop in a city near San Sebastian. The two members of ETA were in a stolen car, and they had to kill him in order not to be arrested. But in the next month, in 1968 still, they carried out the first orchestrated killing, which the victim was Melito Manzanas. He was a police chief in San Sebastian and a Nazi collaborator, also a torturer for the regime.
Yeah, this killing of Manzanas was one of the first, I guess, high-profile political assassinations that really put ETA on the map. And then you talk as well about the assassination of the prime minister a few years later. What exactly happened with that?
In the case of Manzanas, it was the first killing, really orchestrated killing. It was really high-profile. It was cheered all over the Basque Country and Spain because Manzanas was a symbol of repression. And in 73, in a quite cinematographic action. An ETA commando detonated buried explosives in a street in Madrid, while the car of Luis Carrero Blanco, he was, like you said, the Prime Minister of Spain and heir of Franco, his car was blown up to pieces, and the blast sent the car 20 meters in the sky over a five-story building. Still today, you have some jokes and songs about this attack, including people saying that Carrero Blanco was the first Spanish astronaut.
So that was in 1973. You said Franco died 2 years later. How did that change things for ETA? Did it renounce violence at that stage, or did it continue on with the same tactics it had been using?
Well, it continued, but with an increase in attacks. They revised the tactics to expand attacks against Spain. Because as I said before, ETA's main objective was not to defeat Franco. It was a step. The objective was independence. And for them, without Franco, there was a scenario, a new scenario, where they thought that with more violence, they could reach the ultimate goal of independence. As we've seen, it quite happened quite the opposite. The support for the group decreased, and even the support for independence in itself.
So, yeah, can you tell me a little bit about the public's perceptions of ETA and how that has changed? Why were people sympathetic to the use of violent tactics early on? And was it something about the tactics that made the public change its opinion, or were there other factors at play that forced them to reassess this?
Yes, it's a sum of factors, because before the death of Franco, ETA was considered by many in Spain, Basque Country, and even Europe as freedom fighters. They were fighting against a dictatorship. And the number of civilian victims were not as relevant as after the death of Franco, especially during the 80s. Like, for instance, you have the deadliest of ETA's attack in 87 in the parking lot of a supermarket in Barcelona with 21 people killed in a car bomb. And not only the support started to decrease due to this confusion over what were ETA's main objectives, people couldn't understand, well, there's no dictatorship, so why ETA still exists? But also because they started using a lot of car bombs and bomb attacks, and that killed a lot of civilians. So this kind of shaped the view of the general public towards what ETA was all about.
Yeah, one thing I didn't realize until I read your piece was that of the more than 800 deaths that are attributed to ETA, the majority of those actually occurred after Franco died. So I guess in the later 70s and the 1980s.
Exactly, especially during the 80s. Although you have also to consider one factor that was called the Dirty War, the Guerra Sucia. During the 80s, there was a particular war between ETA and members of a fascist group called GAL, allegedly financed by the Socialist Party, that were in power at the moment with Prime Minister Felipe González. And this group was killing Basques, Basque politicians, torturing, disappearing Basques. And so it escalated on its violence as well, also as an answer to the violence of this group, of the Spanish violence, because they understood this group as part of the Spanish state.
So in the Basque region today, what do people think about this goal of independence? Is it something that has a lot of support, or are views pretty mixed?
Well, according to polls from the past 10 years, the support for the independence normally ranges between 20 to 35% of population. It rarely goes beyond 35%. Despite the fact that the majority of the members of the parliament in the Basque Country belong to two of the main nationalist parties, the Basque Nationalist Party and the left wing. But then you have these two biggest parties holding the majority of the parliament, though the majority of the population do not support at this moment the independence.
And among those who do support independence, what is their relationship with Spanish security forces who are present in the region? Your piece starts with this line, it's a joke actually, that, quote, everything is ETA. What do you mean by that, or how does that play out?
Well, since the end of the dictatorship, ETA worked as an excuse for the Spanish government to outlaw political parties, to close newspapers. This year marks the 20th birthday of the closure of the newspaper Egin and the 15th birthday of the closure of the Egunkaria, were two Basque left-wing newspapers that were closed. And journalists were arrested, tortured, exiled during this period. So ETA was really an excuse for the Spanish government to do whatever they wanted, to outlaw parties, to arrest people, to torture, and etc. The most recent case is the 8 young people from the city of Alchashu, or Alsasua in Navarre. They were convicted to 20, 30, 40 years of jail because they were allegedly involved in a bar fight with some civil guards. It wasn't proved to the public that there was really this conflict, this brawl in the bar, but they were convicted in what people in the Basque Country call as a political, part of a political agenda to say that everything is part of it. Despite the fact, it's funny that it makes no sense for a group of people to fight in a bar against civil guards as members of ETA or doing ETA's job while the group was demobilizing and about to announce dissolution.
And so now that ETA is gone, how is that going to change the calculus that the government has to make in dealing with Basque nationalists or people who support the idea of independence?
As of the Altsasu case, we see that ETA is still a very valid excuse, because even though the group has dissolved, their members, nobody knows where they are. Most of the members have been in exile or running from the police forces, Spanish police forces, for years now. So Spanish government probably is going to keep using ETA as an excuse. Though I believe now you have a new scenario where you can move a bit more. You can talk more freely. You can experiment more and try to put forward the agenda for independence more freely than last year, for instance.
So during the few years in which it was very apparent that ETA was declining and losing its influence, what was the approach of the Spanish government toward the group? Did the authorities in Madrid soften their stance, or have they tended to maintain a pretty hard line against them?
It depends. Normally, the governments of the Socialist Party try to negotiate, but with the Popular Party, which just left power a couple of months ago, they never accepted any kind of negotiation. It was really difficult for the Basque population and everyone who were trying to put forward a negotiation, to try to bring all sides to the table to negotiate, to deal with the government of the Popular Party with Mariano Rajoy. In this process of demobilization, of dissolution of ETA, was a process carried out exclusively by the Basque society, with the help of international activists and international experts on human rights. But it was a process carried out exclusively inside the Basque Country, with no help whatsoever from Spain. Quite the contrary, actually.
And now that a socialist prime minister and socialist government has come to power in Spain just last month, would you expect the government's position and approach to change?
Not so much. Not everyone in Spain and in the Basque Country is really content with the new government, is happy with the new government. Three of the ministers appointed to Sánchez's cabinet, the socialist prime minister, have kind of complicated past with both Basque and Catalan nationalists. For example, you have Isabel Celá. She discriminated the Basque language while she was working for the government in Navarre. You have the Minister of Foreign Affairs, Josep Borrell. He's accused of supporting the far-right terrorist group GAL. And the worst minister that Sánchez appointed was the judge, conservative judge, Fernando Grande Marlaskas. He gave very harsh verdicts against Basque nationalists. And he's accused of not investigating many, many cases of torture against Basque so-called political prisoners. Spain was convicted by the European Court of Human Rights 9 times in 9 cases of failing to investigate allegations of torture. 6 times Marlaska was involved. So it's not really a very good scenario for the Basques and Catalans.
When you talk about negotiations that ETA has tried to engage in with the government over the past few years, what are the main points that they're pushing for? Are we talking about amnesty or the treatment of members who remain detained? Or what are they focusing on?
Normally, amnesty. For some time, they were really defending amnesty. Then they've changed they lowered the bar to ask for the political prisoners to be brought back to the Basque Country, because most of the prisoners are not in the Basque Country, but scattered in jails all over Spain. So, which is a huge burden for them and for their families, who have to travel hours and hours. And you have more than almost 20 cases of family members of those prisoners that died while going or coming back from these jails. So this is definitely one thing that ETA has always demanded. Well, the independence of Basque Country, obviously, is something to be discussed at some point. And also, obviously, some other demands as not outlawing certain parties and letting newspapers to keep working, to keep to be open, and well, for people not to be tortured, like the basic human rights stuff.
So how does this dynamic between the Basque nationalists and pro-independence forces in the government compare to what's happening in Catalonia and the pro-independence movement there? Do you think it's useful to think of them as similar scenarios, or are they very different?
No, there's no direct relation to what's going on in Catalonia. I mean, it is good that it cannot be used anymore as an excuse by the Spanish government against Basque activists or even Catalan separatists. Like, there are cases of Spaniards accusing Catalan separatists of having links to ETA. So now this is not possible for anyone to say. But there's no doubt that the timing of ETA's dissolution put some pressure on Spain that resorted to violence in Catalonia during the referendum for the independence in last October. And even with ETA abandoning the violence, the Spanish side was violent against Catalonia. So maybe Spain will have to change a little bit the way they behave and they do things, because they don't have an excuse anymore, even though a thin excuse, because we're talking about a Basque group, not a Catalan group.
And so looking ahead for the future of the Basque region, your piece closes with this scene in which tens of thousands of residents of the region join hands to form this human wall to demand independence or demand the opportunity to vote in a referendum on the independence question. Would you expect now with ETA's dissolution that these types of pro-independence voices are going to continue making their case? Are they going to be more vocal? Are they going to perhaps be quieter? Or what would you say is most likely?
I believe more vocal, because now you don't have that shadow of an armed group casted over the Basque politics. So now you have a new scenario, a new space for debate without this constant fear, both one side fear of this group and on the other side the fear of the response of the Spanish government against those who are allegedly on the same side of ETA. So I believe there's room for advancing the pro-independence agenda. Including, like, if you see Catalonia, there was a small group, an armed group in Catalonia called Terra Lliure, or Free Land. They lasted for just a few years, and they were not really as relevant or strong as ETA. And you see that there is having no terrorism in Catalonia, the nationalist movement had a lot of room to grow without fear, without having to say, okay, let's do this, but I'm sorry for that. I'm sorry for doing that. So you are more free to actually exercise your right to demand independence, to demand referendums, to demand rights.
All right, Rafael, well, thank you very much for your piece and for taking the time to speak with me today.
Thank you very much. It was a pleasure.
Many thanks to Rafael Tzavko Garcia for joining us this week. If you'd like to read more about aspirations for independence in Spain's Basque region, you can find his in-depth article on worldpoliticsreview.com. If you like what you hear on Trendlines, go ahead and subscribe to it in the podcast app of your choice, and please leave a ranking and review when you do so. If you'd like to stay informed about what we're covering at WPR, our free newsletter includes access to unlocked WPR articles all week long at no cost. You can sign up for it at bit.ly/WPRpodcast. And finally, if you'd like to send comments or questions, email us at podcast@worldpoliticsreview.com. Trendlines was produced and edited by Andrew Green this week. You can follow him and World Politics Review on Twitter, and you can find links to pieces covering the issues we talked about in the show notes on worldpoliticsreview.com. Have a great weekend, and see you next week for a new episode of Trendlines.